Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. So, as wages plummet and benefits are cut, how do we pay rising rents? The fact is, people get evicted from their homes and go to live in vehicles. So this week we ask, are we about to see another wave of traveller convoys? Andy Worthington wrote the book The Battle of the Beanfield about Margaret Thatcher's destruction of the traveller convoys in the 1980s. And Sean was on the traveller convoy as an HGV mechanic. Also, Bristol's Gerry activists, Fee Radford and Phil Kingston, big campaigners of non-violent direct action against fracking. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Sean. I'm a new age traveller, but I started in the late 70s and continued on through the 80s, and I'm still living in a touring caravan today.
What about this term New Age? Because I can remember, actually, funnily enough, I was working at the BBC in the 1990s being told we must use this term New Age. There were some travellers that didn't want us to use that term in a similar way maybe to you didn't want to have the journalists talk about you as the peace convoy. You know, that was something that rankled. There was a way that the convoy was talked about, hundreds of people basically moving around the country as they were at the time. What does this term New Age actually mean? Or was it just something to separate you from other
types of travel? It was merely to differentiate between us and the traditional Romanies and the Irish travellers, yeah, because most of us were born in a property of some sort rather than in a caravan. And we travelled in a different way with a different outlook on life and different standards of living and different ways of doing it. So we weren't traditional travellers. So they couldn't call us New Age, old travellers, because we're New Age travellers.
So we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. Roughly,
yes.
How many people were living like this in Britain?
By the mid 80s, thousands. Thousands and thousands of people.
Why so many?
Because it was the time of mass unemployment, industry shutting down. People who were buying a home on a mortgage, suddenly they'd lost their job. The home was getting taken away if they came out with any equity. Buy a £200 coach or lorry light and get it legal. 500 quid later, you've got a home. You've just got to keep it legal all the time and keep moving around. And this is why people
So people were sort of tipped out of traditional kinds of accommodation into this travelling world. Was there any kind of ideology that bound people together, or do you think it was just literally anarchic or something?
Where no, it was a lot of people wanted to escape, besides the anarchy factor, a lot of people wanted to escape from Thatcher's grim Britain because it was getting grimmer and grimmer, and your quality of life, even at the side of the road in lay-by for one night only where you got moved on the next morning, was better than living on some grotty council estate with absolutely no hope in your life whatsoever and no quality of life.
So was it really like that? Every time you stopped, pretty much, you overnight you'd be moved on?
I've been evicted twice in one day. And been evicted on Christmas Day.
And that is because you were what,
on
the side of the road?
St James' Common, Shaftesbury. I got evicted on Christmas Day.
So how long would you be able to stay in the same place generally before someone would tell you to move?
Well, you'd get the police there generally within about the first hour if they hadn't actually followed your convoy of vehicles. Like if you had a smaller group and you took to back roads, it was harder for them. And we, most of us, had a sort of a few places that we knew that would accommodate our number of vehicles. We travelled with anything up to about a dozen vehicles, our particular group. But of course, you did get some big sites where they did stay for months, but these were the exception rather than the norm.
Okay, tell us about your group. What sort of vehicles did you have? What was binding you particularly together?
Mostly coaches and buses, a few large removal type trucks and horse boxes, and quite a lot of cars and caravans.
So what? Why were you at one group and not with other people? What was it that you
because
think that
on
you
big
together?
Sites there was always more problem, and it was much harder to find a site for a lot of vehicles than it was for a small group of vehicles. If there's 6, 8, 10, 12 of you, that's relatively easy to find. A long lay-by can accommodate you for a night. If you've got 40, 60, 200 vehicles, you've got to find somewhere an awful lot bigger.
But isn't there strength in numbers?
There is also, but you come more noticeable, and it's going to attract the attention of the authorities even faster.
Now, you were talking about coaches. What sort of vehicle did you have?
I had a 1950s Bedford 41-seater coach, which was the general size of the average coach that people could buy for not much money.
And how on earth do you sort of keep that up and running? Because obviously it's going to need maintenance of some sort. I mean, how on earth are you going to look after a vehicle?
I'm a professional HGV mechanic by trade.
Ah, but... You'd have
and
to...
worked in a garage on coaches.
Okay, well, that
money.
That does help. So
just a little.
But you don't actually necessarily have that workshop with you as you're travelling, do you?
No, you have to like prune it down to what will go in the boot. In my case, the boot fell out at Greenland's Farm at Glastonbury. So I had to give away most of my stuff, and everything else was in the aisle. And I trod over it up and down all day long until I got a new boot floor in.
So how did you do the basic sort of servicing, repairs and things to your coach while you were...
You knew what was going wrong with it, and you went out to places like the Great Dorset Steam Fair, weird and wonderful ex-Army and ex-RAF people that had these marvellous sheds full of stuff, and you acquired it because you knew it was going to go wrong, and you knew it was going to come up at the MOT. And everybody had different skills that was mechanics.
Well, look, that's another thing, isn't it?
You could get anything done on a site at the side of the road. We've taken engines in and out, and we scrapped a bus in Borough Bridge lay-by. Took us 3 days.
But, I mean, you know, this is another side of it, isn't
anything.
It? Can you keep a vehicle legal? I mean, there's hundreds of vehicles here.
Yes.
But you keep them all legal, really? Taxed? MOT, insurance, all that?
The people that can repair them are interested in repairing them and want to have a good vehicle that doesn't stop and does start when you need to, when you're getting an early morning eviction, as in pre-dawn. Yes.
Because
the ones that couldn't care less, they just left them behind.
Well, there was...
Which happened
I think you probably call it propaganda, but one of the things that was thrown at the convoy was... The many of these vehicles were actually illegal and people shouldn't have been even having them on the road. Say if those people had been living in a town, maybe, the police would have pulled them over, but because they're part of a big convoy, they wouldn't.
People had illegal vehicles only occasionally out of choice, mostly out of necessity, because they just didn't have any money or they were new to it, didn't know how to repair it. But as soon as they got some, they'd pay me or somebody else to come and help them and get the thing legal again. Most people, especially if they had a family, wanted to have a legal vehicle.
Yeah.
If you only paid £100 for both vehicles, you've paid a £50 van and a £50 trader, who cares? You go and buy another one in the next scrapyard, you're fine.
Effectively, people, most of whom have been made homeless one way or another.
Yes.
Was it felt as an awful kind of way of living, or did you manage to make the best of it?
No, better quality of lifestyle for what was available, better than people already had. And also, there was a certain defiance. You know, people didn't want to be ruled by the government and have to live in these dreadful places and be on the dole all the time. If you're going to be on the dole, it's far nicer to be out the dole in a nice country park up somewhere. You don't care if you move 5 times in a week. Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Well, I'm also joined by Andy Worthington, who's written a book about the denouement, I suppose we'd call it, the convoy. In 1985, called The Battle of the Beanfield, both the book and this denouement. What's your view of, Andy, of how so many people came to be living in vehicles at the time?
Well, I think, you know, we've been discussing that it was a terrible time for unemployment in those early years of Thatcher's prime ministership. 3 million unemployed, I remember, in 1981. And, you know, we are also talking here about cheap vehicles. It's clear from your experience that having somebody there who knew what they were doing with vehicles was extremely important. But the way that you could get cheap vehicles, and I remember quite a lot of, this seems weird now, but quite a lot of ex-military vehicles were being made available, weren't they, quite cheaply. So some people who were on the road were actually in vehicles that they'd bought cheap off the state, and then found themselves hounded by the state for travelling around in second-hand vehicles that they'd bought off the state in the first place.
Yeah. Absolutely. We used to go to military vehicle auctions where if you turned up with cash, paid on the auctioneer's hammer, paid your 10% buyer's premium, you could drive it away. They weren't asking to see legalities. They just wanted to sell it. All ex-War Department stuff they just wanted rid of. And you could get anything up to an 8x8 if you wanted to with a crane on it. All sorts of 1940s onwards vehicles.
And these were built to last, some of these military vehicles. Yeah, yeah.
Some had only done 500 miles.
Brilliant. But, you know, you mentioned propaganda, Tony, and, you know, and I think there was a lot of propaganda at that time when the state started clamping down on the fact that people were travelling freely, quite anarchically, around the countryside. And what it really fundamentally touched on, I think, was that however much this was articulated by the people who were travelling, they were attacking the establishment's sense of land rights and what belonged to whom. And that's really, in the end, why they got so upset.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the CPRE Britain, aren't we? Campaign for Protection of Rural England. Suddenly, 10, 20, even 100 vehicles turning up in your village could upset some people.
Well, at ground level, I'm not sure. I mean, Sean, you know more to say about this, but
Upset Tory voters.
I know at the time of the Beanfield, for example, that Nick Davis, who was one of the few journalists, I mean, Nick Davis, working for The Observer at the time, hooked up with the convoy, travelled around, experienced the Beanfield firsthand, is from Wiltshire, and he said, look, the mainstream media put out this notion of, like, oh, the convoy, and started spreading all these lies about criminality and violence and drugs and guns and stuff. And he said, you know, this was all part of propaganda. What he found generally as the convoy travelled around was that ordinary people didn't object to the convoy. It was a colourful experience. It wasn't, they didn't have this, you know, this particular desire to put the convoy down. That was something that
we've seen exactly the same here in Bristol at Greenbank with the caravans that have been parked in Greenbank for a long time. I went along and knocked on a few doors. Nobody had any problem with the caravans actually being there.
Right.
They were saying the problem was that the council weren't taking the rubbish away,
right,
that sort of thing. So I could definitely corroborate that. But hang on, there's a bit of an accusation there, Sean. Drugs and guns. Is that any truth to that?
There isn't. That's no more representative of a society of what any form of traveller than it is in, like, the general population. It's just it's made more out of, like, yeah, any grain of truth that there may be. That's not generally the case.
Okay, what about the run-up to the Battle of the Beanfield then? The Stonehenge Festival was quite a part of that. I don't know, were you involved at all in the Stonehenge Festivals, Sean?
Because I worked at Glastonbury, because it was my main earner, we were there so long because I used to do all the telephones, and I'd have to take all the cables down. We were never able to go to Stonehenge because it was either just before or just after Glastonbury when we were working, because that's the one earner that's going to hopefully keep you going through the winter. It's the one time when hopefully you'll go home with maybe four figures worth of money in your pocket, and that's keeping getting your vehicle legal and keeping going through the winter. Because nobody had any normal fixed jobs. You can't have when you're being evicted all the time.
But the Stonehenge Festival was a sort of parallel to Glastonbury, going on around about the same
time. Yes, always
yeah,
was.
People forget that. They weren't
far there. Earlier than Glastonbury even.
And it was, I suppose, a free festival. People just turned up.
It was always a free festival. In the 60s is when people first started going there.
The only trouble is, of course, as a festival gets more popular, we've seen this with St Paul's, it gets bigger and bigger, it gets more problematic, all of the regulations then start coming down. But did you, either of you, see any of that going on at Stonehenge?
My last experience of Stonehenge was about 1990-ish, driving in a double-decker with somebody with a modern video camera on it that was videoing it, and I was just met by this wall of policemen. It wasn't my decker. I was driving for somebody who'd just come out of hospital and they couldn't drive. And it was just, I can't believe this. Please tell me it's going to be all right. And they magically parted and let us in. But there had been, after all the previous times with it before, obviously one was nervous turning up there. And that was about one of the last times where they allowed vehicles fairly near the stones.
I think with the festival, you know, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I went the last few years, so it was noticeably bigger in 1984 than it was in 1983. But if you look at those times, you know, they were a particularly dark time, I think, for British society. If you weren't from this narrow group of people that were fanatical about whatever it was that Margaret Thatcher was trying to do, and its popularity was based on so much opposition to what was happening in Thatcher's Britain. This is the year of the miners' strike, for example. So that summer it was huge, and I think by any way of reckoning it, it was something that was difficult to manage. But I think it was the sheer size of it that wasn't necessarily as much of a problem on its own terms as it was when how that was perceived by the establishment, because that was obviously the point at which Thatcher got together with people to say, you know, this has got to come to an end. This was coming from the very top of government.
I mean, there were a whole series of battles in the 1980s, weren't they? What with the Wapping, with the print unions?
Yeah.
There was, as you mentioned...
Well, Wapping kind of followed, yeah? So she had the miners, then with the Beanfields she had the Travellers, and then the year after that she had the printers. Now, the way that the miners and Stonehenge are tied in so closely together is that her first serious onslaught on the Travellers was in the summer of 1984, just after Orgreave. And it's really kind of crucial historically to remember not only the brutality of Orgreave and the continued and very valid calls for a proper investigation into policing and the miners' strike, and particularly Orgreave, but what these paramilitarized cops at Orgreave were doing, then going down the road to a festival
the next day
at Nostell Priory, and the way that they treated the convoy that was at Nostell Priory, which, Sean, you can talk about. I wasn't there, but I believe you were there, yeah.
A friend of mine, his girlfriend, was 7 months pregnant. Two police dragged her down there, one of them kicking her in the stomach. She was 7 months pregnant. That's the only thing I want to comment about. I don't want to say about any of the other things. So we just like that's about
you
the worst like thing
lot,
that
Paul,
I can
really.
Actually say that I definitely know happened.
So
I know both
where was Nostell Priory?
It was not that far from Orgreave.
Sorry,
it was in Yorkshire.
Yeah. Quite near Wakefield.
Yes.
And how many people were there? What sort of land was it? Why was it
about
a problem?
About 2,000 to 3,000 people plus day visitors, I would say. Yeah.
And it was a festival. Or just
unfortunately,
campsite.
It was the festival was sponsored by people that were alcohol sellers in the local area. I can't mention their names, obviously, and their interest is in getting people to drink as much as possible. And of course, we know when with drink go other things, like yeah, and it all got more and more out of hand, and then yeah,
so
things happened like yeah that we knew that like you know there was going to be a response and. It was Monday morning when they came in.
I don't want to be too conspiratorial, but did you ever see any evidence of agent provocateurs? We know that they have been used by the authorities in the past.
Yes, all the time. Do you want to know when the last time I saw them was? Watchfield Festival, which is the replacement for Windsor, which existed for a couple of years. And they had a police roadblock either end, so we all had to make it through and show our documents and you know, all of that. And this transit...
You're giving the sign there for being frisked, aren't you?
Yeah, okay. And this transit made it onto site suspiciously after our like group of about 15 vehicles made it on about 2 hours later and cruising around, blowing exhaust, no tax, bald tyre, like, yeah, and looking like hanging. We knew it was like the police because they'd actually gone over the top and they looked too crusty. We made an attempt to get clean. They were so crusty, they'd actually put it on. So they blew their act, and like somebody just said, I'd get it back to the station if I were you boys, you know, and it disappeared off the site then. That's the truth.
So, yeah, but did they actually do anything?
They were cruising around taking numbers, because people used to take number plates, do a number plates run, so you entered on, like, to a file.
Yeah,
that's a different matter than, like, infiltrating the convoy. And I'm not sure that I have heard about the convoy being infiltrated in the same way that we've heard, obviously, so much over the last few years of the infiltration of various protest groups by the police. And
this so-called...
It was hard to do, because you all knew each other. I knew lots of people from school, you know, and things like that.
Yeah. So
no,
it's the old boy network.
No, not at all. It's, if you don't know somebody, you have got the 5 seconds to make up your mind when you're walking towards somebody or when you meet somebody, and you've got that 5 seconds to make up your mind, like, are they good or bad, no matter who they may be and in what situation they may be. And you have to make up your mind and hope you've made the right choice. and you get better and better at it the more.
I think there's probably quite a lot of, you know, really, really finely honed bullshit detection that goes on when you're living on the road. Because, yes. You know, because it isn't as though you're settled in the city where, you know, you actually have to court confrontation. You're actually, you know, you've been preyed on the whole time, yeah? You know, and when every time you stop at a lay-by, you know, the police are going to be there within an hour. Oh. It's like, you know, you need to know to trust, I imagine.
I mean, yeah? The thing is, every now and again, I would imagine, Sean, that, you know, you come across somewhere which was absolutely blissful and you didn't get any trouble. What did you? Is that true? Somewhere you arrived like that? Can you remember anywhere that was really, actually you thought, well, like, we could stay here for
1986. We pulled onto a gravel dump on the way to Gillingham off the A303. Lovely. Had a pair of gates on it, council gravel dump. They'd used all the gravel, lots of space for us, and we had about 6 or 7 vehicles. Second night, first night we got loads of catcalls and honking. Second night, it was coming up to November the 5th. I lived in a petrol coach. It was quite cold, like in October, so of course the petrol fumes hang around under a petrol coach and they started fireworking us. But they only carried on, like, for that night. The next night, unfortunately, we took our own action. I remember phoning up to say I'd just put a lorry piston through the window of some car that was fireworking my petrol coach. And the police said, well, if somebody comes in complaining, we'll come and arrest you. Truth and fact. And the next morning, just funnily enough, at 7:30, we got the customs and excise fuel testers turned up and came straight towards my vehicle.
Sounds like you're saying, no, we never did find anywhere really
not for long.
Idyllic at all.
No,
in all
not
those
for long.
Years. No, really?
Yeah, there are some places, but you only stayed there a week, so you didn't hot them up because you wanted to go back again the next, you know, 6 months or a year later.
Some places were better than others. Yeah,
yeah. Some places were better than others.
Some counties were better than others.
Dorset, Wiltshire and Cornwall, just forget them.
Right.
You know, grief.
So Devon and Somerset.
Devon and Cornwall Constabulary. Somerset Constabulary were like fairly tolerant actually, but Wiltshire and Dorset not tolerant at all.
Did it all just depend on the whim of the chief constable and the landowners?
It depended upon the attitude, and of course we had those things called gypsy liaison officers that came into being then, like, which were suddenly applied to people who weren't traditional gypsies, and they'd come and put their 2 cents worth in, which they always did. They'd always turn up if you'd been anywhere for a couple of days.
There was definitely something, though, about, you know, I mean, the chief constable was specifically appointed to Wiltshire to deal with, you know, what eventually happened with the end of the Stonehenge Festival and the Beanfield. And they were liaising with, if I recall correctly, it was, I think, 6 counties and the Ministry of Defence that had police that were involved in the 1,400 people who suppressed the convoy at the Battle of the Beanfield. So those 6 counties... Obviously, all of those chief constables, and I don't off the top of my head know which those counties were, presumably surrounding Wiltshire.
So, Andy, can you...
We're all working closely together with the government.
Can you run us through what happened in the summer of 1985 then?
Well, it all follows on, really, from Nostell Priory. So from Nostell Priory, the convoy was harried right south down the country. Parts of that convoy that survived ended up at Molesworth, so Rainbow Fields. That's a really crucial part of the story.
Which was the start of Rainbow Village.
Right, the Rainbow Fields, Village, yeah, at Molesworth, yeah. Which was supposed to be the second site of cruise missiles in the UK after Greenham Common. I don't think they ever used it in the end. But when that was evicted at the start of February... That was when Michael Heseltine, led the largest peacetime mobilisation.
Thatcher's defence minister.
Right, yeah. And it was the largest peacetime mobilisation of troops in modern British history.
Against civilians since Winston Churchill sent in the troops. Yeah. That was the biggest ever mobilisation, absolutely. Yeah.
And so from that moment on, anyone who was on the road from Nostell Priory and from Molesworth was being followed. You were, like, not allowed to rest, as far as I understand. Everybody was travelling around for another 4 months until the Battle of the Beanfield. And in the meantime, all of this stuff had been put about injunctions preventing 84 named people from going anywhere near Stonehenge, and they were making these plans, which was that, you know, they wanted a roadblock. What happened on the day was that those people that left Savernake Forest, because some people stayed in the forest...
Yes.
The ones who left were supposed to be blocked. The outlier on a motorbike saw what was happening, and they went into the field, which was one of several fields. One of them was the Beanfield, where the whole thing unfolded during that day. And then, you know, it was a day of pretty extreme violence, I think it would be fair to say. that the police were assaulting men, women, and children and destroying vehicles. And the shockwaves that went through the travelling community after that were, I think, it's fair to say,
were quite profound.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then Thatcher introduced new laws the year after in the Public Order Act of 1986.
12 vehicles.
There we go.
So, Sean, did it have its desired effect, the Battle of the Beanfield? Did people start to think, well, we can't carry on anymore living on the road?
It brought it to public notice more than anything, because the police seized some footage, and there was a D notice, I understand, issued, because ITN had footage that they didn't release, and I possibly may still have, but the BBC, of course, gave up like good little boys.
So but the police,
I've seen some unseen footage.
So the police come round to the broadcasters and they say, actually, we need that footage for evidence, and they want to take that footage. Now, at that point, some of the broadcasters might stand up to the police, others might cave in.
No comment about the BBC, please.
Well, I think that ITN?
ITN, in fact.
It might be HTV, actually. It was called
HTV.
Nick Davis from The Observer, who had a photographer with him. Those photographs disappeared from The Observer's offices under what I believe are mysterious circumstances, and some of them later reappeared. But the full footage, I don't think, is...
Have you seen the footage of Phil the Beer's fire engine burning on Stonehenge? Because I've seen that.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's one of the ones they didn't show.
Right. So this is getting a bit Orwellian, isn't it? Erasing history, really.
Right.
This never happened.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly.
Well, it was partly, and the fact is, what they didn't want was a forensic analysis of what happened. They were quite happy that they'd pushed their narrative of how these were dangerous people who needed to be stopped. And what they'd been able to do, which was kind of crucial, was that they couldn't be seen to do that kind of stuff to the women who were troubling them immensely at Greenham Common, because they were all women. And you couldn't practice that kind of violence. But when they had a convoy of men, women and children...
And women and children, didn't
then
matter.
they could get away with the violence.
Also, to do it in a field in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and using Stonehenge as the excuse of, our precious national monument... And these dirty, dangerous people who've been defiling it every year. So they built up that narrative very consciously, which enabled them to do things that they really shouldn't have been allowed to get away with. And then afterwards, you could see that because they tried covering their tracks. Yeah, they didn't really want people actually being able to see the kind of violence that was practiced on women and children on that day.
Sean, do you think the convoy achieved anything? I mean, obviously, it was a place to live for people.
It brought things to people's notice that there were people whose options would be possibly otherwise limited through financial or other circumstances, through environment or whatever, who are having a better life. But also, it was quite political, because it was effectively a protest movement, but on wheels. And, of course, that's insurrection, effectively, as far as the government sees it. So, of course, it's going to stamp on it. They produced whole mines of disinformation which was spread out. Travellers make Hell's Angels look like Little Noddy, after 84 Stonehenge, it was awful. Are you joking? We're not that bad.
Yeah, right.
Also, I wonder if, Andy, if it, maybe the whole problem, so-called, with Travellers was the same sort of thing as we've had for centuries with travelling people, gypsies generally?
Well, I think so, I mean, I do really fundamentally think that one of the things that annoyed the establishment the most, as I mentioned before, was that this infringed on their notion of land rights. Having people travelling around, parking up wherever, taking land and raising the issue of the ownership of land, because that's what you're doing when you're taking over a bit of land, whether you're just going to stay there for a couple of nights, whether you want it to be a festival site, whatever you do, you are challenging their fundamental notion of who owns what. And, we aren't supposed to think about this that much, are we? But as soon as you start digging, you realise that, a small number of very entitled people are actually running the show when it comes to land ownership. And they don't want people upsetting things by reminding
people of that.
But the
thing is, there's also
then getting
the fact,
more and more people out on the road.
There's also the fact that you end up with thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that don't have anywhere to lay their head at night. So surely, I mean, something has to be, there's got to be a balance between the two. You can't just have, there's a whole swathe of the population that have got nothing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't see why, you know, I don't see why you can't have people who are mobile rather than settled, except that, of course, it taps into, you know, an ancient and very long-standing prejudice by settled people against nomadic people, which, you know, it seems to have been running through almost all human history wherever you can find it, is that settled people very easily take up a very prejudiced position against people who dare to be nomadic. But I would say that the times that we're living in at the moment, Tony, are such that I would completely understand it if people decided to take to the roads in vast numbers, because we've now got people priced out of the ability to live in cities very cynically and very deliberately by people who are just trying to trap them and enslave them financially. And the same spirit that motivated people in the 70s and the 80s, I would say, is, you know, is ripe for happening again, frankly. But, you know, I'm sure they've put everything in place much more to try and make sure that they can control us in a way that that isn't going to happen.
Did you ever find, Sean, that you had some sort of sympathy from the authorities at all, ever? Like with the police, for, you know, if, say, for example, if there's some people fireworking you, you know, was the police 100% against
you? Well,
I
really told you what they told me.
No, in that case, yeah, but did you ever find any kind of sympathy from the authorities in anywhere?
Generally, you'd get more sympathy from somebody that was the local ordinary beat copper, didn't want to be out there. He'd been ordered to be out there, and he just could come out and say, look, boys, we're going to be here whenever. And it didn't happen. More so in Somerset, I feel. But there are always some policemen who are all right and like, OK, look, we're coming for a police eviction. We're going to turn up, you know, with some diesel. You know, don't worry. And they would turn up, but they'd only give us red diesel, which is funny enough. We were getting evicted from Paradise Quarry. They'd given everybody red diesel.
So that was, the way they got you to move with a whole load of fuel.
So I got 4.5 gallons of petrol. Thank you very much, like local police force, like Avon and Somerset.
What about today? Thatcher's Britain's long gone, although the effects, of course, are still with us.
The rumble-on effects are still with us.
Is it feasible, do you think, to still live a travelling lifestyle of some sort today? I mean, obviously, there are people doing it, aren't there? Some in various places. I mean, sometimes you just come across them. I was up in near Stroud recently on one of the roundabouts, a whole load of caravans on there for 3 or 4 days.
People are now, it's either they cluster around the edges of cities, like we have here in Bristol, and generally have fairly large commercial sites, because now, of course, they can't take, it's more difficult with private land, or especially if there's a domestic residence on it. But a lot of people you won't find unless you go somewhere really remote and you just happen to find them. No more than 2 or 3 vehicles normally.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people have been on the droves in Wiltshire for ever since the 80s and are still there now. Some have been on the droves in Somerset since the 80s. They're still there.
And was it because the convoy had this political edge to it, you think, that it was so targeted? And because obviously it was big and organised?
Well, it was seen as challenging, like, the government, and challenging the forces of law and order, and challenging perceptions.
And the scale of it, the number, sheer numbers of people involved in it was getting more and more attractive. So, you know, they saw it as a threat and cut it down. It's good to hear that, you know, that people are obviously under the radar all over the place in much smaller numbers. But I think that it's sad that you know, that they did crush something to an extent that if you somehow raised your head above the parapet, they'd be on you again. You know, it's like you have to keep it really low key, yeah?
What about
you do? It doesn't matter how low key you do it. Yeah. I own a piece of land and I'm getting grief, and I've got a touring caravan on there, and that's the only thing they can moan about. And they came there on the pretext about a month and a half ago of you storing stuff on your land. It's my stuff and my land.
Right, yeah. Okay,
so do you think we'll see anything like the convoy again, Sean? I mean, remember, we're in a situation, aren't we, with actually enormous property bubble, housing bubble, which could go bang any time.
And Brexit, of course. And, of course, the two are tied together. Property values have gone down in some places, not only slowed, they're actually going into negative life value. You know, people who've got somewhere in Wales they're trying to sell now, take Port Talbot, for example. There's an awful lot of work there now.
We've also seen quite a big rise in evictions, in particularly in areas where universal credits come in, and people literally living in cars.
Yeah.
Because they get evicted, because it takes anything up to about 6 weeks to get the payment. And, of course, most landlords won't stand that. They'll stand the 1 month, 4 weeks, and then after that, it's the eviction. And some of them can evict you in a week or a fortnight, depending upon what bit of paper you sign.
We're even getting some parts of the country, areas where at dusk people gather like 10, 12, 20 vehicles because there are so many homeless and they've decided rather than sleep in a doorway, Andy, that they'll, you know, they're going to use the car.
Yeah.
Or a camper or something.
They go off to work in the day and then they come back and they've met some other people that are in the same situation and they're doing just the same but in a more low-key way and not so noticeable because generally estate cars and plain vans, you know, without stovepipes and things like that. And there's loads of people living in every city like that.
Yeah.
Both like from... who've come here from Europe and who are like, you know, homegrown British people without a home.
I wonder, Andy, if you think maybe that the Battle of the Beanfield was just trying to hold back something that was inevitably going to happen.
Well, I think if you're taking the really long picture, I mean, we're talking about stuff that happened over 30 years ago. So following those leads, you know, they'll lead in different directions and some of them peter out and some of them carry on. But I think the essential pressures that were on people involving work and homes at that time, you know, they reconfigure, but they come down to those being very crucial things. If there isn't any work, what the hell are you going to do? And if you start living in a period like we're living in now where we've got such horrible and horrible aggressive policies towards people and their homes and where they live.
A hostile environment.
A hostile environment for people who are renting properties and who are not awash with money. Then yeah, I think you could certainly say this was them holding something back that has now returned. And hopefully it's going to, you know, cause them some trouble, I think, because something needs shaking up.
Did you feel a bit like trailblazers at the time, or were you just doing what you had to do, Sean?
Well, not earning an awful lot, having to pay an awful lot somewhere just to park, because my first, like, proper size travelling vehicle was a removal van that I used to work in the day and sleep in at night in lay-bys. And that was getting old, like, yeah, when you've lived for a few years in a small removal van and everything folds up and you have to fold it up and put it in the front and then you go out and work on hauling furniture all day long, gets a bit old. So that's when I decided I was getting something bigger, hence I bought a coach. And that was a better option to spend every halfpenny I had on that, put as many tools as I could get into it and go off, because I knew it couldn't get any worse than living in a van and working day to day and just about having enough to eat at the end of the day of a whole day's furniture lifting on my own. And that's the truth.
Well, what about the price of housing today? I wonder whether someone somewhere, maybe after Brexit, might set up a factory producing living vehicles of some sort, converting vehicles or something, because it seems like it's something that's not going to go away.
We're already doing it in some way in Bristol. You know that. Container city.
Well, I think with people living in cars that we were talking about, I also think that if you were to, you know, closely examine the whole caravan situation and fixed home situation where people aren't supposed to be living, I think it's now fair to say that people are living where they're not supposed to be living. I think there's people living in containers. I mean, years back, you know, I was storing leaflets in a container, one of those container areas for a job that I was doing, and there was a guy who was living in his container, and the owners were kind of, you know, turning a blind eye to it. There's all kinds of stuff going on now, isn't there? There has to be, obviously. You know, the cost of living is so insane that it's dispossessing people at a furious and alarming rate. So people are finding creative ways around it, I think.
A nasty container that's like living in a steel coffin that sweats every night, but it's got a lock on it. It's worth 30 quid a week if you work, even if you're working on minimum wage. Everything you've got is safe. Yeah, it's horrible. You'll probably go and try and sofa surf, but everything, your few possessions are safe, and you have somewhere that you can go to in an emergency.
There you go.
That's as best as people have got, and that's terrible. If that's the best they can aspire to have a damp container and not even fit it out as a home, that's appalling.
Well, if the government can't do something about this, well,
yeah,
what's the point of having them, I say. Anyway, Sean is 66 years old, still in his caravan. Lovely to have you. And also Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and also The Battle of the Beanfield. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much indeed for having us.
Yeah, it was great.
We've enjoyed it.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Fee Radford, and the group is called Grandparents for a Safe Earth. And the gentleman I'm here with today, Phil, founded it about 6 years ago, would you say, Phil, 6 years ago?
So, Phil, can you just tell us, give us your name and tell us about what made you start it?
My name is Phil Kingston. It began just after the time of the occupation movement, and a few grandparents happened to get together, and we began talking about our campaigning, which we were all doing. And the usual conventional campaigning of writing to MPs and ministers and the media, etc., we realised we were just being cooled out. You know, it was a way of not really engaging with us. So we were determined that we would take actions, non-violent always, which we regard as peaceful and respectful. And sometimes we have broken the law, and that's in a very mindful way, we hope, you know, which we're trying to let people know that this is so serious, that this being climate change issues particularly, that we are not going to let them pass.
The first question, Fee, is what floats your boat? I mean, what is it that because we see so much, don't we, on our daily news programmes. Actually, I find myself fuming. Much of the change going on in modern society seems to be for the negative, one reason or another. Not enough money for this, not enough money for that.
Yeah.
And so what is it that you moves you to action?
Well, what really fires me up is runaway climate change, because that, for me, overshadows and encompasses everything else. I have a little three-year-old grandson, and I seriously wonder what his future is going to be like. His childhood won't be anything like the one I knew when I was his age.
But how can you take action? What have you actually done?
Well, this is where the grandparents come in, because we've taken a lot of action. As Phil has already said, we take direct action, always peaceful and respectful. The very first action we did was to occupy Barclays Bank on white ladies. And
how many of you?
I think there were about three or four of us at the that time, and the police came and escorted us out. And it's escalated since then. We hit a few more banks. My son says, "While you're there, Mum, you might as well perform a heist." But we're not interested in the money. We're interested in getting their management to change their policies.
So why Barclays?
Well, Barclays have a particularly bad reputation. Barclays were behind the fracking in Yorkshire and owned the company that were doing it. That's gone a bit quiet now, because when the Minister for Business looked into their balance sheet, he found that they were very much in the red.
But what's wrong with fracking? I mean, this is a new type of energy, isn't it?
Where do I start when telling you what's wrong with fracking? Everything's wrong with fracking. At the local level, it's dangerous for the water table, and there is a real risk of polluting the water. It also uses vast quantities of water, and in Lancashire, where they're going to start fracking very soon, they're on a hose pipe ban. So you can imagine how the locals feel about the huge amounts of water that are going to be used in the fracking process. But there are other risks with fracking too. There's the risk of escaping methane gas, fugitive emissions they're called. So that we don't want escaping.
But I mean, surely your target shouldn't be Barclays, it should be the government, because Barclays are going to finance something if it's legal, and fracking is legal.
Yes, so we did go to the government. That was our last and biggest action. We occupied the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy for 6 hours. Five of us were locked on in the foyer of this government department.
Phil, can you tell us what that means, locked on? It doesn't sound like you're not going to be easy to shift.
Well, it means basically chained together, but I think it's called locked on because the modern way of doing this is you've got these tubes which you both put your arm in, and inside are some little metal things you can clip onto, and then you wrap the end of the clip around your wrist. So it's very hard to move you, especially if they're a number, because then, you know, it's dangerous to move you.
Mm. Why did you choose this particular protest then?
We were going to go to a fracking site in Lancashire at Preston New Road, but the firm organising that, just before we were going to head there, they put a civil injunction on, and the cost of this, financial cost, can be enormous. I mean, people could lose their homes.
Okay, so...
So we went to the government instead.
How did they know you were going?
They didn't. No, no, there'd been protests there for a long time. It just happened to coincide with our little plan.
Oh, right. And so what do you think you achieved by going to the government?
Well, we did have a BBC radio interview, and that at least turned up in Somerset, where two of our members live, and they had a 10-minute interview there a day or two later. Mostly it was via the social media. We were with somebody very experienced in that, and she was sending out messages and pictures. And.
But that's all talk. I mean, is the government really going to change what it's going to, you know, is it going to stop fracking?
At the moment, no. But we regard these things as process. You know, we were meeting, for example, members of the security staff who would say to us quite openly, look, I'm a grandfather. I believe what you're doing is right. I'm glad you're here. Well, that's their security staff. So it begins to open up the reality of people's different views within the department. And that just goes more public.
Mm. Fee, do you ever get nervous doing these things?
Yes, I'm always a bit tense beforehand.
Get butterflies, kind of.
Definitely get butterflies. Mm. When I'm nervous, I kind of quieten down and everything. But once we were in there, then it felt really good. What we were doing was right. One of the reasons that Phil hasn't touched on was what we wanted to encourage the activists up in Lancashire who had been every day outside that fracking site 24/7 since January 2017. And when this injunction was slapped on them and they weren't allowed to take any more direct actions for fear of very draconian penalties, their morale was very low. They were quite down. Mm. And so when they heard that a group of grandparents had tackled a government ministry in London, they were overjoyed. It really lifted their spirits. They cheered and clapped, and we didn't know at the time, but we heard later.
Well, do you know, between you and me, whoever has the highest morale always wins. So well. maybe anyway. So Phil, what about next? I mean, it's not just about fracking this. You've got other ideas in your sights, haven't you?
Yes. In fact, we'd like to tell you about something that's coming up quite soon. On the 8th of September, there is what's being called Rise Up for Climate. So many organisations in Bristol, which are concerned about what we've been talking about, will come together and in their own way contribute to it.
Yeah, we're meeting at 12 noon on College Green on Saturday the 8th of September. Mm. Groups will be processing there, but individuals and families are all welcome. Bring their banners, there'll be speeches, there'll be songs, and there'll be music. And the aim is to raise up our voices so that our elected representatives know that we care about climate change, and that we're calling upon them to take long overdue, active and ambitious action.
But hang on, because quite a lot of us are enjoying a real hot summer. Mm.
But you're not enjoying the sight of the fires, are you?
I mean, these fires occur naturally anyway. I mean, every so often, the moorland in this country has caught fire. I mean, we've got records of this going back hundreds of years.
The science is very clear from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that something like 12 of the hottest recorded years are in the last 15. Mm. Now, that can't be disputed. And all of the graphs you see, I mean, they're issuing another rather emergency report next month. which I think is going to, you know, be quite shocking in many ways.
I think the case is decided.
Yeah.
And even the BBC is now forsaking its balanced attitude when broadcasting.
What do you make of Mr. Trump then? Because he doesn't really believe it that it's even happening, does he?
Disaster.
In fact, he's pulled out of, well, he seems to pull out of all of the agreements that have ever been made by the Americans, including the one with the Iranians.
Exactly. Yeah. When I heard he'd been elected, I wept because I knew it was terrible news for the climate. Fortunately, though, lots of states in America are taking independent action. And the reason we're having this big rally on the 8th of September is that the following weekend, there's going to be a huge global summit in San Francisco. And it's going to be mayors and governors, people at that level are being called to take action and to kind of just bypass Trump.
Could even be isolating him.
Well, I mean, that's a concern in many ways because, you know, he does seem, if I may say so, a rather dangerous man. And I think it's better for people to keep trying to connect with him and just give different viewpoints.
Why is it, do you think, that he's disconnected from this international Paris agreement, though? Because this is quite a major break that the Americans have made, isn't it? Why has he done that?
Well, I'd say he's done it because the big thing which is not talked about over here or there and across the world is the relationship between the global economy and the destruction of the Earth. That is off limits. And I'm really glad to be able to say it on your show here because I just think it is so important. And we see in some ways our government doing similar things. You know, the move to austerity. It is not fulfilling its next two targets on climate change reduction. They have this independent committee, which was reported 2 months ago, and that has said it explicitly.
Well, we had a campaign here in Bristol, didn't we, at the beginning of the year, actually. It was actually the research done by Friends of the Earth, and the display was on the bear pit, and it says 297 deaths per year associated with air pollution in Bristol. There was a hashtag, which you can still look up, of course, on Twitter if you do that sort of thing. Let Bristol breathe. Hashtag let Bristol breathe. And another advert, which was there for everyone to see at the bear pit, saying, warning, you are now entering dangerous and illegal air pollution. Let Bristol breathe, Friends of the Earth. Now, how come Bristol is allowing this illegal amounts of pollution?
It's a very good question, a very good question. It was discussed in the council, and I actually spoke on behalf of Friends of the Earth and asked for a large diesel-free area in the city.
It's just too many cars. I mean, you can remember when the railways were around. In fact, in our streets, in our residential streets, you'd sometimes get one or two cars in an entire street.
Yes. Those were the days. Now you can't move for them.
Grandparents for a safer Earth, Fee Radford and Phil Kingston, and you don't have to be a grandparent. No. You just have to be over 60 to join. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for asking us. Yeah, real pleasure to be able to talk about these things and you know, imagine it going out to folks and saying, and look at our website. We got a website, Grandparents for Safe Earth.
You can Google us.
You can find a way of contacting us.
How many of you are there?
Well, I don't know. On our membership list is quite big, isn't it? Yeah. But active members are about 20, perhaps.
Yeah.
Around that. Mm.
Anyway, Fee and Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
Can we put one more little plug for September the 8th? Don't forget, if you're feeling in despair about climate change, come and join with others and raise your voice on College Green at 12 noon.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Traveller Sean and Andy Worthington, author of The Battle of the Beanfield. Also to Bristol's geriactivists you just heard, Fee Radford and Phil Kingston. And to studio engineers,
Dave Bazanko and Belty Campos. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop at 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till the same time next week here on Dialect, goodbye for now.
Beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene. Can easily understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means to me, Jolene. Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 please don't take him just because you can. You could have your choice of men, but I could never love again. He's the only one for me, Jolene. I had to have this talk with you. My happiness depends on you, and whatever you decide to do, Jolene.